From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Mark Report. It's the 29th day of April 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group. He's in Decatur, Illinois. In agricultural news, the U.S. Supreme Court today heard a case about a Roundup-ready crop. Chinese farmers are increasing the use of farm machinery. About 50% of that nation's grain production is now done by machine rather than by hand. As was the case in the United States, farm mechanization, of course, comes with social consequences. And Walmart has a new food safety program for the beef products it sells. The program targets the suppliers of the red meat. Dave Dickey will have details of these and other stories shortly. In the second half hour of our program today, on some of these radio stations and always online at willag.org, we'll talk more about those same red meat suppliers with David Ray of the American Meat Institute. Our topics will include food v. fuel, vertical integration, packer consolidation, and emigration. Hey, and in just 26 minutes, we'll talk with meteorologist Peter Levitt. He'll join us to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Here's the way the numbers settled up in Chicago on a Thursday afternoon. Futures finished the day like this. The nearby May wheat at 484.5, up 8.25 today. July at 495.5, 7.5 cents higher. In September at 511.5, up 7.25. July wheat in Kansas City, a settlement price 5.5 cents higher at 507.5. From the corn pit in Chicago, nearby May futures 360.5, 3.5 cents higher. July at 369, up a nickel. September at 376.25, 5.25 higher. In December corn, $3.83.75, up 6 cents. March futures 396.75, up 6.25. May soybean futures 985.75, up 3. July at 996, up 2.5. August at 994, up 2.75. September 979.5, up 3.5. And November beans $9.70.5, up 5 cents a bushel today. May bean meal 287.40, down $1.20, and the May bean oil at 38.80, up 26. April live cattle futures 98.97.5, up 92.5 cents today. The June at 93.87.5 for the live cattle, 45 cents higher. The feeders finished the April contract at 113.50, up 22.5. As did the May at 112.52.5. May lean hog futures $87.60, down 60 today, and the June at 83.82.5, 77.5 lower. This is the Closing Market Report. Here's what the outside markets look like for the hour. Crude oil futures, $85.17 a barrel, $1.95 higher. July at $87.27, up $1.60. May ethanol, $1.60, a penny higher. Natural gas in the June contract at $3.97, or rather $3.98. It's up 36, or rather down 36.8. And the heating oil futures are up 2.4 of a cent at $2.25.3. The gold futures, a settlement price, $1,168.40 an ounce for the May contract, down $2.90 on the settlement price. The Dow now stands at 11,169. It's just about 124 points higher. The U.S. dollar at 82 even, down 0.37. The CRP index at 275.29, up 0.78. And the Goldman Sachs today at 544.38, up 5.4 on the afternoon. A quick look at the weather forecast for the afternoon tells us in Champaign-Urbana there will be a wind advisory in effect. If you've been outside, you already know that. Until 7 today, mostly sunny skies, a high around 77. The winds out of the south at 25 to 30 miles an hour. They'll gust up over 40 miles an hour. And then this evening, partly to mostly cloudy, windy and mild, a low of 58. The wind from the south at 15 to 25 miles an hour and gusty. And then tomorrow, sunny, windy, warm, high of 79. The wind from the south at 18 to 25 miles an hour with gust over 35 miles an hour right here in Urbana-Champaign. And on tomorrow evening, cloudy, breezy, mild, some showers and thunderstorms. The low tomorrow night of 62. And on Saturday, we'll have a high of 76 with interval clouds and sunshine and a few passing showers and thunderstorms, especially very early in the morning, a high of 76. More on the agriculture weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour and talk with Peter Levitt.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media on a Thursday afternoon. Time to check in on the agricultural futures markets. With us today, Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group out of Decatur, Illinois. Good afternoon to you, Dan.
Hi, Todd.
Sunny and windy here, and things are blowing around in Chicago a bit, too. And they finished higher for the day. What'd you make of that train?
I think even though we did fall off of our highs, and I think that was pretty well expected, there was good country movement today throughout the Corn Belt. So farmers have been selling into the rally here, and that kind of took things off the edge, as well as your day traders. They sold off their positions. But all in all, we did end up maintaining a higher close. So that kind of keeps the market in position anyway to close out the week with a higher finish.
Is that good news for the longer term or not?
Well, corn, for the most part, is going to have a weekly reversal to the upside unless things would totally fall apart tomorrow. And in this type of market, I wouldn't be surprised if anything. But we are in good position to close out the week higher with a weekly reversal.
Yeah, okay.
And then close out the month higher with a monthly reversal on at least your individual contract months like July and September and maybe even Dease corn. May corn is going to look more like a double bottom, but we did take out the March low by a half a cent or a penny or something like that right after on April 1st. But for the most part, April's been a sideways to maybe a higher month if we go ahead and finish out the market higher, which I think from a technical perspective suggests that we got more to the upside to go in here.
Forget the tax. Take into account the historical perspective and what you know about the marketplace. How often does this, you think, happen in the month of April? And is it good news over the long run as we head into the rest of the season, as long as we have a normal growing season, that is?
Well, the market has been counter-seasonal basically since January. Ever since the January report, the overall trend has been counter-seasonal. At least if you look at the last 15 years or so, I even got some 30-year charts. But that doesn't mean that it can't get back in sync with the seasonal, and I think this week's action implies that maybe the market might want to get back in sync with the seasonal pattern. And seasonally, it's not uncommon to have a late April low and then have a firmness sideways to higher, maybe into a June high.
What do you have as upside potential marks? New crop and old crop corn.
Well, I think the upside, it would not surprise me that we could maybe go back to that early March high. I think that is a possible target, which would be like around the 402 area on the July contract. But we do need, in order to really, I think, dress up the charts to get there, we need to kind of close out the week, I think, here above this 375. We really need to kind of clear. We did clear it on an intraday basis, but we were unable to finish above this 375 area. But if we could start closing above 375, that would also be closes above the 50-day moving average, and I think that would really open up the gates or dress up the chart pattern that a lot of technicians would begin to talk about a challenge of that 402 high in the July. I think if you want to start looking at December, we weren't able to do it yet today. We need to kind of clear this 395 area. That, again, would also be closes above the 50-day moving average. And if we could do that, that could maybe dress up the chart pattern to kind of take on this 410-415 area that we had a little rally high point up there in the first part of March.
Do you think the bulls or the bears will have the upper hand in the trade tomorrow, and who has more at stake?
Well, I'm always one to count the money on the table, and after tomorrow, unless the bulls give it back, the bulls will have the most money. They'll have the money on their side of the table tomorrow, so they won the week. It looks like they're going to win the month. Therefore, I would say that the bulls have the edge going into May.
All right. Tell me about soybeans.
Soybeans, I think, was more of a spillover market, probably from the corn market. The China news has really given the corn market some juice, and also China continues to be a buyer of new crop beans as well as old crop. So we had good set of weekly export numbers on new crop beans here today. I think probably the beans struggled somewhat under maybe a short corn, long bean spread. I think over the past month, people were putting on that short corn, long bean spread, especially the last couple weeks when we've been doing some planting. So if we do see some more strength and follow-through strength in corn, that could keep the soybean market in a struggling mode. Unless we come back fairly strong tomorrow, beans could kind of be in the opposite position. The bears will end up winning the week, but for the month of April, though, the bulls have won it clearly with a strong 60 to 70 cent advance.
How about for the wheat? Have you been watching it very much?
Oh yes, I watch wheat all the time, and. Some of the technical trading system that I put together over time here, it did go long wheat here yesterday, and I guess I'm inclined to go along with that and think that the low that we saw here in wheat last part of March, first part of April, may go down as an early harvest low. We have been taking out previous rally high points, and the breaks have been above the previous corrective low. So we have tilted the underlying trend to sideways to higher. But I do think we need some good, we need a good solid nice close tomorrow. If we could kind of close this July wheat above the $5 area, I think tomorrow, I think that would kind of shore up a sideways to higher trend going into May.
In your broad perspective of the marketplace, does this all tell you that, for instance, crude oil is headed to $90 or something thereabouts, that the world economy is on the recovery? And what about Greece?
Well, Greece is a problem. Portugal's a problem. Spain's a problem. My guess is that will get resolved somehow. At least they'll patch it up, and then it'll be our turn. So I think that the strength that we've seen in the dollar because of European problems may be subsiding at some point in time here. Once they get that all resolved, then maybe the dollar will have a setback, and that would help us out over on the commodity front, fluff up some of these prices as we go into a seasonal, into the growing season. Of course, you look at crude oil at $85. What we need here is we're up against the blend wall. We do need an E12, E15 to kind of get ethanol product moving. I think if we would see that, that alone would be a big beneficiary to corn prices. I think you'd be surprised how big a boost that could actually give corn prices once and if we get this EPA expanding the blend on ethanol.
Agriculture is pretty split on that one still, with the livestock and the grain operators landing, of course, on separate sides of the issue. Do you think U.S. EPA will come to a conclusion that E12 or E15 is okay?
My guess is they will. I think energy values and energy prices are going to be constantly at the upper end of the price range, and I think any movement into cushion energy price strength and to move the country into cleaner combustible fuels, I do think that that's the way the trend will go. Granted, everything runs into resistance here and there, but I get my guess is that will the doors will open to expanded use of biofuels.
Dan, thanks so much for being with us today.
Very well.
Dan Zwicker is with ADM Grain Group out of Decatur, Illinois. He joins us from his offices there each and every Thursday afternoon on the Closing Market Report.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Bob Baesdefer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Now remember, if you'd like to hear what Dan had to say again, you can always do that online at willag.org. That's willag.org. Or you can pick up the phone and dial this number, 217-333-3434. We'll post a bit of analysis in either the opening or the closing numbers to that voicemail at 217-333-3434 by about 10:15 and 3:15 daily. Dave Dickey is here now. He's your Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media and has all the agricultural news for the afternoon.
In agricultural news, attorneys arguing before the Supreme Court to overturn a judge's injunction banning the planting of Roundup Ready alfalfa told the high court that it will likely be at least a year before USDA completes an environmental impact study that could allow farmers to plant the crop. In the first biotech crop case to arrive at the Supreme Court, Monsanto Company and the Obama administration challenged a district court injunction issued 3 years ago that created a nationwide ban on planting Roundup Ready alfalfa. USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service has received more than 145,000 public comments on the draft environmental impact statement being created to potentially deregulate Roundup Ready alfalfa. A ruling on the case by the Supreme Court likely will be issued in early summer. China's Association of Agricultural Mechanization says that PRC farmers are increasing their use of farm machinery, freeing up millions of rural laborers to migrate to urban areas. 49% of grain production, sowing, cultivation, and harvesting is now being done with machines. The Chinese government encourages farm machine use, providing a subsidy to farmers when they buy new equipment. To meet demand, the Chinese farm machinery industry has been expanding by 20% annually in recent years. Meanwhile, China said Wednesday it plans to impose a new set of tariffs on U.S. chicken products after conducting an investigation that found subsidies had created an unfair advantage for U.S. chicken producers. The new tariffs, which go into effect on Friday, follow China's decision in February to impose anti-dumping tariffs on U.S. chicken products because it found those products were being sold at less than fair value. Walmart Stores says it will implement additional beef safety measures to protect customers against foodborne illnesses. The new program requires Walmart and Sam's Club beef suppliers to implement controls to reduce potential contamination levels. Suppliers who do not operate slaughterhouses must comply with the new standards by June of 2011, while beef slaughterhouse suppliers will have a two-step approach, with the first step to be completed by June of 2011 and the second by June of 2012. And CME Group Incorporated today says that profit rose in the first quarter in its best quarterly showing since 2008. Net income rose 21% to $240 million, or $3.62 per share. Revenue rose 7% to $693 million as trading climbed 12% to 11.5 million contracts. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. That's public radio for the farming world. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, hoping that you'll stay with us for the second half hour of our program today when we'll talk with David Ray of the American Meat Institute. If it doesn't show up on your radio station, you can always pick it up online at willag.org. Now up next, yield response to seeding rates for soybean are flat. The high cost of a bag of soybeans, as you already know probably, is causing farmers to lower their seeding rates, and that's okay. I'll have more with Vince Davis. It does not necessarily follow that more soybean seeds put into an acre of farmland produce a higher yield. Extension soybean specialist Vince Davis from the University of Illinois says the response is really pretty flat.
The response to seeding rate in soybeans is really wide, meaning there's not a lot of yield response for a very wide range of seeding rates, provided you get good stand establishment. The ultimate goal is that we want 100,000 uniformly spaced plants per acre once they're established. So growers should calculate basically back from that based on the type of planter they have, the planting system, their seedbed preparations, and the germination rate of the seed that they're using.
If, Davis says, a grower is doing a good job of seedbed preparation and expects to have good germination and emergence, then maximizing the economics of soybean production might come at a seeding rate somewhere between 130 and 150,000 to the acre.
As you lower that seeding rate, you want to have more assurance that you're going to get more of those seedlings or seeds to germinate and emerge up and out of the ground. And so we do see the value of some seed treatments. The value will increase as you want to reduce that seeding rate a little bit. And historically, we've used untreated seed, but we've also been planting at 170 to 200,000 seeds per acre. And so if you lose some of those seedlings to seedling diseases, it's not as large of an impact as it would be to lose seedlings to seedling diseases if you're only starting with, say, 120,000 plants to begin with.
The ultimate goal, says Vince Davis, is to get 100,000 plants per acre and to optimize management to achieve that target. You're listening to the Closing Mark Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. In just 2 minutes, we'll take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast with meteorologist Pete Levitt.
Support for WILL comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks by developing dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is at stuart-peterson.com.
In business news, Potash Corporation of Saskatchewan today says its first quarter earnings were up, driven by a sharp rebound in potash demand and increased sales of phosphate-based and nitrogen-based crop nutrients. Net income in the quarter ending March 31st rose to $449.2 million, or $1.47 a share, up from a year earlier profit of $307.4 million, or $1.01 a share. The company raised its full-year earnings forecast to a range of $4.50 to $5.25 a share from a previous forecast of $4 to $5 a share. Paul Volcker, a special advisor to President Barack Obama, yesterday said that a value-added tax was not on the table for the U.S. in the near future. The former Federal Reserve Chairman also said the U.S. should begin with Social Security as it attempts to tackle large budget deficits. He suggested that a rise in the retirement age be considered. Commodities bull Jim Rogers says agricultural commodities were left in the dust as base metal prices boomed last year, but now represent the better investment. Rogers says, quote, "I'd rather buy agriculture, which didn't move up, and I don't want to buy base metals because they did go up." And Burger King said its fiscal third quarter profit fell 13% on a higher tax rate and bad winter weather that crimped sales. Burger King earned $41 million, or 30 cents per share, compared with $47.1 million, or 34 cents per share, a year earlier. And that's a look at today's business news.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. On the line with us this afternoon to take a look at what's been happening in the world of windy agricultural weather is Pete Levitt. He's in Massachusetts. Good afternoon to you, Pete.
Good afternoon, Todd.
It is really windy here this afternoon. Winds flying at us, well, not too bad. I think it says 10 miles an hour at the moment outside our studios, but it's got to be gusting a lot better than that.
Oh, it is. The airport within the last hour had a gust over 50 miles an hour out there. So that is windy. That actually was the highest reading I saw in the state for that hour. But still, it's right there. That's where the winds have kicked around from southeast to a more southerly direction and sort of a warm front type of thing. The temperatures, as you see, right up there in the upper 70s, and a beautiful day today if you don't mind the wind. And we're going to see that wind die off this evening. Winds will stay south. A storm system has come up through western Missouri and through Iowa up into Minnesota. And that's got a cold front behind it, which will move across Iowa. But that front's going to be rather slow moving and probably will still be west of us tomorrow during the day. Later in the day tomorrow, though, moisture will get up in there, and we'll see some showers and thunderstorms developing tomorrow afternoon. But mostly tomorrow night, I think, is when we get the thunder showers. And still, they don't look particularly heavy, maybe a quarter to three-quarters of an inch amounts in the central and northern parts of the state. Looks a little heavier down the southeast, where we could see an inch to an inch and a half by late Saturday. The front will continue on through, albeit slowly, so we'll probably see another little round of showers on Saturday. But then the rest of the week looks variable clouds. We're not going to see a dry spell again. There's still a lot of action going on. And the greatest amount of activity will be just to the south of the Ohio River, where it looks like inundating rains will occur over parts of Kentucky, Tennessee, Mississippi, and Alabama during the early part of next week. Some areas there should see in excess of 3 inches, maybe 3 to 5 inches in some of those areas.
All of that rainfall, not so good for one of your favorite crops. That's fairly disease-prone for wheat, especially in wet weather.
Yes, it is. And we're looking at the fusiform diseases here taking place, and, you know, look for mildew and that sort of stuff. The wheat crop has done reasonably well. The temperatures in Kansas were cold this past week, but not enough to cause any damage. And the heading had been a little bit behind, but now it's coming along. And we don't see any very cold weather during this next week. Maybe a little frost in northwest Kansas, eastern Colorado for the winter wheat, but nothing over into Illinois or the central part of the Corn Belt. And that crop is faring pretty well. And, of course, corn, the planting just went ahead like mad this past couple of weeks. It's at a record pace in planting. And that's usually a sign of better than average yields. There's a correlation between early planting and better than normal yields. And that even includes some of the drier years.
Thanks so much, Pete.
Mm-hmm, my pleasure.
Pete Levitt, agricultural meteorologist, joins here on the Closing Market Report on a Thursday afternoon. For some of our stations, stay with us. For the farming world, for the rest of you, so long for the afternoon.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today, we'll talk with a representative of the American Meat Institute. AMI is a national trade association that represents companies that process some 95% of red meat and 70% of turkey in the United States and their suppliers throughout America. Dave Ray is Vice President of Public Affairs for the American Meat Institute. Mr. Ray, thank you so much for being with us. Why don't you tell us first about the American Meat Institute and who funds it, who it represents, and what you do?
Okay. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to get to share some of what we're doing here in Washington and across the country with your listeners. AMI is America's oldest and largest meat and poultry trade association. By American standards, we're actually ancient. We were founded in 1906 in Chicago. We represent America's meat packers and processors. So for those of you who aren't in agriculture, by and large, we do not produce the animals that we eat. We purchase the animals and turn them into the meat we eat. So if you walk into the grocery store and you look at the meat case, by and large, those are AMI's members representing red meats and turkey. We have been moved from Chicago to Washington, D.C. several decades ago and are located in downtown D.C.
And what is your primary function?
Our primary function is to represent the interests of the meat and poultry trade industry here in the United States, both in terms of domestic policies, in terms of legislation on Capitol Hill, regulations, if the government's considering regulations to the industry or legislation that's going to affect the industry one way or the other. Also to try to work we have a vice president of international trade whose full-time job is really dedicated to working to open up markets because, as all of us know, most of the consumers on the world on the planet live outside of the U.S. borders, not inside of them. And so international trade is certainly a big issue for us. So we work on those issues and make sure the interests of meat and poultry packers and processors are represented well in Washington.
And do your members fund the organization, and how's that happen?
Yes. Our members fund their membership is decided by the size of the company. We represent companies, you know, that are the largest meat packers and processors in the U.S. all the way down to your mom and pop shops that have maybe 2 to 3 employees. Their dues are determined by their sales and the volume of employees. And so we are funded by their dues.
And so what kind of companies would most people be familiar with that are members? For instance, I'm looking through some of it. Cargill, obviously a member. Purnell's, which makes sausage, people probably would recognize that. Hormel, I see, as a member.
Yeah, so
Johnsonville Brats,
all
those sorts of things, right?
Yes, exactly. If you walk down the meat case and look, about 90% of the folks representing those packages there are going to be our members.
Yeah, so I see Kraft and Louis Rich.
That would be
Oscar Mayer and Louis Rich and all kinds of folks. Those are the people. Omaha Steaks is there for people that are shipping through the post mail.
Mm-hmm.
So you represent these organizations. You told me as we got started that one of the primary interests at this point was corn-based ethanol. What mm-hmm. side do you take on this issue?
Well, we tend to be a very much a free trade, free market organization, meaning that, you know, we like to to see as much of the government's interference out of the markets as possible. When it comes to the issue of corn-based ethanol, I think we probably all agree that America needs to be looking elsewhere for fuels. Instead of importing it from abroad, we need to be, you know, investing in biofuels and finding ways, finding alternatives, domestic alternatives to purchasing and burning foreign oil. Where that becomes a problem, though, is when the government takes sides and decides that it's going to support one industry over another. And what happened in 2007 is that the government, in essence, created an entire new domestic market for corn-based ethanol because it mandated the amount of corn-based ethanol that was going to be that had to be blended into the gasoline supply. What it in effect did was create a whole new market for corn-based ethanol and diverted much of the corn that we use, that we feed to our animals, into the fuel supply. So instead of consuming corn, we now burn it. What that did in 2008, if you remember what corn prices did in 2008, some of them went up between $6 and $8 a bushel for some period of time, and caused a lot of pressure on food and feed prices. For us in the meat and poultry industry, corn is the largest single input to the animals that are raised for human food. And so when the government makes a decision that it's going to take the corn supply and burn it, which by the time the ethanol mandate is finished, we will be burning 40% of the corn raised in the United States as additives to gasoline. So we're not talking about a small percentage of corn. Right now it's about a third of the corn supply we're burning. What that has done is to a number of things. It has placed it is at least nearly doubled for a set period of time, the price of corn. So if you double an input, you're going to drive the price up. So the government has caused the doubling of corn price, near doubling of corn prices. It has created a new market that's going to have an ever expanding appetite for corn, and it's by and large going to be forcing consumers into a situation where they're going to have to decide whether they want to put fuel in their tanks or food on their table. We, you know, like I said, have support the formation of a very healthy and stable biofuels industry, but we question whether or not the government should be supporting one biofuel over another by giving corn this extra impetus. It's really been at the disadvantage of other competing biofuels. But secondly, and most importantly, is the question of whether or not it makes good sense and whether or not it's really ethical in the long run to be taking a large amount of your food supply and burning it in a world where there isn't an overabundance of food. And our burning our corn supply has global ramifications. So I mean, we have asked for, really what we're pushing for right now is a policy that would remove the subsidies for the corn-based ethanol industry. It's currently getting tax credits. And the government is also blocking the importation of ethanol from other countries. We could be and so we're just saying, you know, remove the government support that the ethanol industry has had for 30 years. Let the industry compete on its own merit with other biofuel options and stop blocking possible imports from other countries. Let the market determine the cost of grain, not the government, and we'll all accept it and move forward from there.
Mr. Ray, I have a question, which is, do you really believe that the price of corn went to as high as it did, into the $7 level in 2008, based off of fuel-based ethanol? I mean, crude oil doubled in that same time frame. Are you blaming Congress and Washington, D.C. for that impact, and are the two not related?
Well, obviously the two are related. Now that the price of corn has now been coupled with the price of oil, since it is considered another source of fuel. Certainly the mandate to burn 30% of the corn supply to divert it into the gasoline tank did have some impact on the upward pressure of corn prices. I didn't say it was completely that, but it certainly was a major impact. We don't see, what's the problem with putting all your eggs in one basket? I mean, we support a portfolio approach to biofuels, corn-based ethanol, second and third generation biofuels. But the real question is whether or not we want to be burning a large portion of our food as fuel. And I think it just doesn't really make sense in the long run.
But if you take a look at total amount of corn that's been produced in the United States over time, while we are now approaching 30% that is going to produce ethanol, the amount of corn that's available has not run out and has not really come into short supply in any form or very short supply. We haven't emptied the coffers at any point in time. I'm surprised that you're taking such a hard line, given that many of your members also would be users of corn for food products.
We are not taking, we are the corn farmers' best customer. We intend on remaining their best customer. Our beef is with corn-based ethanol. And whether it is really in the long-term best interest of this country to be burning its food supply. And we believe that the ethanol industry has had 30 years of government subsidies that were intended to get the industry on its feet, let it learn the ropes, and compete in the free market system. Enough is enough. Budgets are tight. If the corn-based ethanol industry is going to make it, let it make it on its own. Furthermore, we believe in free and fair trade. We shouldn't be blocking ethanol imports from Brazil because our industry can't compete with them. If our industry is going to make it, it's going to make it without government help based on a free market scenario. That's all we're asking for.
Okay. Good enough. Let's move on to other issues. The industry structure and the way it is put together. Part of this has to do with packer consolidation, I suppose. Other part has to do with vertical integration. Which side do you want to take up?
Well, honestly, this is a topic that the government is having seminars around the country to address these various issues. And without getting too deep into it, because I'm not really a policy expert in industry structure, one of the issues that we confront when this topic comes up every several years is whether or not the packers should be allowed to use any type of marketing agreements or contracts to partially own or control animals as they're coming into the process. And we've, believe strongly that marketing agreements are very favorable to both producers and packers, that it allows for cooperative agreements between producers and packers, and ultimately helps provide consumers with the type of meat products that they're wanting to buy. We believe these are tools that have been developed in the free market system, and they should be allowed to remain.
We're talking with the American Meat Institute's David Ray this afternoon. More on our conversation when we continue with The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Learnerd Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnerd Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. 2270.
It's National Shrimp Scampi Day. Shrimp were well known by the ancient Romans and Greeks, but shrimp scampi, as known in America, did not become popular until after World War II, when a number of Italian dishes went mainstream, often appearing as a staple on cafe and restaurant menus. One of the most popular dishes consisted of large prawn tails coated in breadcrumbs and deep fried. Incidentally, scampi is not one set recipe, but a generic name applied to several dishes composed of shrimp. On this day in agricultural history in 1768, George Brandt died. A Swedish chemist, he discovered the element cobalt in 1730. Cobalt is used in steelmaking and is an essential part of vitamin B12. In 1856, a shipment of 33 camels arrived at the Texas port of Indianola. They had been purchased on the North African coast for the U.S. Army to use in the deserts of the Southwest. In 1873, the first U.S. patent for a railroad coupler was issued to E.H. Janney of Alexandria, Virginia. And in 1998, Brazil, in light of increased soybean acres, agreed to set aside about 62 million acres of the Amazon rainforest for conservation. The cost of the project was estimated as much as $156 million. And that's this day in agricultural history.
This is the Farming World from Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We're on the phone line this afternoon with David Ray of the American Meat Institute. When we last talked with him, we were discussing vertical integration within the packer industry. Mr. Ray, I'm wondering if there are reasons that packers should not own animals.
Is there a reason for packers to not own the animals?
That's the question.
Not that I can think. Not that I can think of.
Well, is unfettered capitalism in this point good for democracy, do you think? I mean, in the idea that locally owned businesses are good for democracy and having ownership in the nation itself is good for democracy, and that very large organizations, whether it be a consolidated packer, and there aren't very many packers. How many packers do we have in the nation at this point?
The processing plants are broken into both federally and state-inspected plants, and together there are about 3,000 federally and state-inspected slaughtering plants in the U.S.
Right, but owned by how? But owned by how many companies, David?
I don't know that number.
How much of the meat goes through very few of those companies? Do you have an idea? I'm sure you do.
Yeah, there are both on the beef side and on the pork side, a very high percentage, upwards to about 80% of the packers process. I'm rifling through here. If you look at daily hog slaughter, you have about the top five companies account for about 65% of the total. If you have daily cow slaughter, you have the top four companies account for about 55% of the total. But that's leaves a lot of room for smaller companies. Our point is this, is that we're talking about a producer and a packer, a single producer who is looking to you can agree to not go into a marketing agreement, which many producers opt not to, particularly on the beef side, or you can decide to go into a marketing agreement. It's a way of hedging your risk. A marketing agreement allows you to team up with a packer to agree to a price in advance, whatever other types of specifics you want in your contract, and to deliver your product on a given date to the packer. What it does for the producer, it's a way of hedging risk. You can lock in your price in the distant future. It kind of protects you from fluctuating grain prices and so on. For the packer, what it does is, this is a manufacturing industry. It locks in a guaranteed supply of animals to keep your lines running. It also allows packers to try to set up what kind of specs they're trying to get from producers for the animals that they're producing, or for the meat that they're producing. You know, a lot of the high-value meats that are being produced are your branded meats. And one thing that we see from consumers is that they like consistency in products. Well, how do you get a consistent product if you don't have an agreement between a packer and a producer on what kind of animal that they're going to produce, what the, you know, kind of the weight specs are going to be, and so on and so forth? So we honestly believe that these are the type of free marketing agreements that producers can opt in or opt out of that allow us to give the consumers the type of meat they want to purchase.
One final issue I know you wanted to take up, immigration reform. And you have been actively involved in immigration in the United States for quite some time. Is this correct? First, you spent 15 years as the chief media spokesman for the Federation for American Immigration Reform?
That's true, yes.
Right. So what's the American Meat Institute's take on immigration reform?
Well, we have been long supporters of comprehensive immigration reform. I mean, if you look back even to when the Institute was founded in 1906, the meat packers and processing industry, it's always been a gateway industry for new immigrants. These are jobs that are largely don't require a high level of education. They're jobs that come in that even at the turn of the century till today, people with limited English can get their first step to the American dream. This is a lot of times very hard labor and very, you know, kind of meat locker, cold environment, sometimes wet. So by and large, some of these jobs are jobs Americans simply don't want to do. We've found that we've been blessed by being a gateway industry. But immigration reform is something that the country's going to have to get a handle on. We have been long supporters of comprehensive immigration reform, which includes border security. It includes the mandatory use of the E-Verify system, which would allow employers to validate whether or not a new employee is legally permitted to hold a job in the U.S. We've talked about trying to put forth a pathway to legalization for the people who are here and working already and paying taxes, to give them a way to legalize their status, and then for future worker needs, some form of guest worker program. Now, this is at this point kind of a policy position. I don't know what kind of hope comprehensive immigration reform has in this Congress. Former chairman of the RNC said this weekend, immigration is an issue where both sides lose.
Thank you so much for being with us. We're all out of time. I do appreciate it.
Great. Thank you.
David Ray is a vice president of public affairs for the American Meat Institute. You've been listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.